Hello and welcome to the Career Changers podcast. I'm Elisa Martinic and I'm the founder and editor-in-chief of the Career Changers. I'm definitely one of them. I learned from my experience that following our dreams requires courage, self-awareness and a lot of inner work. I love to discover stories of career change and share them with the world as a source of inspiration for all those who are still searching. Career changes are not a straightforward chronology written in our CVs, but the sum up of our dreams, ambitions, failures, and successes. The Career Changers is an online community that aims to inspire thousands of people during their journey to self-realization. We discover and share inspirational real-life stories of career change. We inspire people that are thinking to change career. We support people that want or need to change career, but feel stuck or lacking confidence and clarity. We connect and collaborate with organizations that support career change across different industries. I believe that thinking to have only one job or career in our life is a limiting belief, unless the job or that career make us happy. Life is a journey, and with one third of our lives spent working, it would be unimaginable to not have a desire to explore new avenues. Welcome to the Career Changers podcast. Hello and welcome to the Career Changers. Our guest today is Dave Liu, a 30-year veteran of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. He's an entrepreneur who has started multiple companies, advisor who has raised over $15 billion for hundreds of companies, and investor in multiple billion-dollar exits. Dave is author of The Way of the Wall Street Warrior, a humorous and irreverent guide to conquering the corporate game from a Wall Street veteran who went from the proverbial janitor suit to managing director at one of the top investment banks in the world. Using tips, tricks, and smart cuts from Dave, we can learn how to build our career for success. The book sold almost 10,000 copies in the first 2 weeks of launch and reached the top 10 Amazon bestseller list in the business finance category. It ranked as Amazon top first hot new release in two categories, business finance and economics. It was also awarded one of the best books of 2021 by Bloomberg and the Porchlight Book Company business bestseller in November 2021. Today, Dave is here with us to talk about his career, the best-selling book, The Way of the Wall Street Warrior, and tips, tricks, and smart cuts to build our career for success. Hi, Dave. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good, thank you. That was quite of an introduction. So I'm really curious to discover everything about your career, your book, and anything that you would like to share with us. So let's start with your background. In your book, you mentioned that you went from janitor suit to managing director at one of the top investment banks in the world. How did you start your professional life, or better, what was your first job?
Yeah, so my first job was actually, I lived in Hong Kong. I grew up in Hong Kong, and I worked actually in factories where I assembled electronics. So I assembled watches and Game Boys, things of that nature. And I was doing this probably around, 11, 12 years old. That's when I first started working. So I guess I was the classic kind of sweatshop employee. And then when I moved to the United States for college, my family was in very tough financial situation. We were essentially at poverty. And so I basically had to do whatever I could to make a living. And so in between school, I would work in any odd jobs I could. And so my first real job in the United States was working at Safeway, and I was paid $3.35 an hour. And I was essentially the lowest of the low on the hierarchy at Safeway groceries. And so I did everything that nobody else wanted to do. So I did the cleanup in aisle one when someone spilled milk. I would do the sacking groceries. And then I would have to clean the bathrooms, which I will tell you, one of the most disgusting bathrooms in the world are in grocery stores. I have no idea why. I just think people think that, hey, you know, some kid is going to clean this up anyway. And so I can do whatever I want on the floor. And so that was probably the worst job I ever had, because there's frankly nothing that teaches you humility more than being a janitor. And I had to clean up stuff, you know, using ammonia, which I'm pretty sure killed a few of my brain cells.
Well, I guess it also gave you a lot of motivation to get out of there.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think crappy jobs, really bad jobs, really teach you is the value of everything. I remember when I was young, and I still do this today, and I'm almost 50 years old. I always think about the value of things and the price of things relative to how much labor is involved and how much of my labor is involved. So when I was really young, I would look at everything, every purchase, every investment, everything I would do with my money relative to how many toilets do I have to clean at $3.35 an hour in order to pay for that, you know, $5 burrito or that, you know, trinket that I wanted to own or buy. And I think it really grounds you because it really makes you appreciate how hard it is to generate income to buy the things that you want. And even to this day, as I said, even though I'm almost 50, I still kind of look at those things that way when I'm looking at buying a car or making a purchase. I think about how many hours of work would I have, would the 16-year-old Dave Liu would have had to do at $3.35 an hour in order to pay for that.
Oh, that's so cute. Anyway, I really understand. I had some experiences when I was younger as well. So I think, as you say, that tough jobs are good for motivation. If you take it in the right way, like you say, okay, this experience, I don't want to stay here. What I need to do next?
Absolutely. I've had so many lousy jobs in my life. And thankfully, the really, really bad jobs I had when I was really young. And I will tell you another thing that doing really bad jobs teaches you is it teaches you to be humble. When I was graduating from the Safeway jobs to working at Target. I worked at Target at the department store. I was a little bit higher than a bagger. So I didn't just do bagging, but I was doing a little of cashiering as well. And I'll tell you, I was terrible at it. And I really wondered if I was just an idiot. I really wondered if, man, if I can't master how to use a Target cashier machine, then am I really going to be good at anything? And so I think it teaches you a lot of humility when you do really bad jobs. And so thankfully, I graduated from one of the top schools and I actually got a taste of Wall Street when I was really young, when I was 18 years old. And I got an opportunity to do an internship at Goldman Sachs, which even to this day is viewed as one of the top investment banks. And that experience really shaped me because of two things. One was that the amount of wealth creation I saw on Wall Street just boggled my mind. I was an 18-year-old kid who was at poverty. I ultimately graduated with $100,000 in debt in 1993. So that's a lot of money, even now, but that was really a lot of money in 1993. And just walking around the Goldman Sachs headquarters and seeing artwork on the wall that would represent two or three or four years of my compensation just boggled my mind. And so the amount of money flowing around Wall Street had a huge impression on me, particularly given my financial situation. And then second, I realized by being in that environment that this was actually something that I could probably be pretty good at. I could see what was required to enter the industry. And one of the things that I preach heavily whenever I give advice to people that are thinking about career changes or looking to scale the corporate ladder is I always advise them to observe and study what do people in that job really, really, really do? Because usually what you see on the website or what recruiters tell you or what even people that come and tell you about their job, what they tell you is not necessarily what they do on a day-to-day basis. And it's always shocking to me how when people first join new work or new career, they're shocked at what actually they need to do on a daily basis. And so when I was really young, I would study and observe very carefully, what do people here on Wall Street actually do, like on a daily basis? And is that something that I can do? And not to be critical, but when you look at the junior level of Wall Street, it really comes down to two main skills. One is you're pretty good or really good at Excel. So you're really good at moving numbers around on a spreadsheet. And then the second thing is you're really good at PowerPoint. You are an apostle at the altar of PowerPoint, and you know how to use it and how to make presentations. And I will tell you that those are really the two main things that you do as a junior banker on Wall Street for many, many years. Now, as you move up the ladder, you know, you have to build other skills and whatnot. But when I saw that at Goldman Sachs, I realized that, hey, this is something I could be pretty good at. I'm pretty good at Excel and I'm pretty good at putting presentations together. And so that was why when I was really young with a lot of debt, I decided, you know what, I'm going to jump head into this industry because it'll get me out of debt pretty quickly. And I think I could be pretty good at it.
So what was actually your dream job when you were a child?
Oh, my dream job was to do more of what you see behind me, which is this is a Chinese painting that I did when I was around 12 years old. And, you know, if you're not a Chinese painter, and apologies to people listening to this on a podcast because they're not going to be able to see this. But when you look at it from afar, it actually looks pretty good. But then when you look at my calligraphy, which is terrible, by the way, if you look at my calligraphy, it's a dead giveaway that, oh, wow, you know, the painting looks pretty good, but this calligraphy is absolutely terrible. So the calligraphy is a dead giveaway that whoever did this was pretty young. So I did this. And I would tell you that when I was really young, I really wanted to be an artist. I wanted to write stories. I wanted to paint. In fact, I joke that I wanted to be the Chinese Stan Lee, the guy who created the Marvel Universe. And I used to draw Spider-Man and his enemies all the time when I was a young kid. But as an Asian American kid, particularly, you know, with Asian American parents, there was a lot of pressure on me not to pursue anything like that. In fact, the general advice that you get from parents is you got to do something productive. And for a lot of Asian families, that is focusing on, you know, science, technology, engineering, math. So the classic STEM categories. So when I was really young, I wanted to be an artist, a cartoonist, and draw. And unfortunately, reality set in, and I ended up pursuing a career in business, in technology, in finance. But now that I've had the fortune of being able to do lots of different things, I've been able to go back to my original roots. So that's why I decided to become a writer and write this book and put cartoons in it. It's why I've started to think about other things that I want to do, like entertainment and filmmaking and animation and cartooning. It's because I now have the financial wherewithal to pursue lots of different things.
So you mentioned your education earlier on. So what is your educational background?
Yeah, so I'm definitely, I think, on a relative basis, highly overeducated. So I went to my really young education was that I studied under the British system of education. So I took the GCSE, for your British listeners, they're familiar with it. And so I did that through my kind of K through 12 years. And then I studied at the University of Pennsylvania, and I focused on engineering at the engineering school. And I majored in system science and engineering in manufacturing and robotics. And then I got a business degree from the Wharton School, and I focused on finance. And then I got a MBA from Harvard Business School later, several years later. But I will tell you that, and this is obviously going to be listened to a lot of people, like, I've never really been that interested in business. I've really did it more because, one, I was pretty good at it. And then two, it opened a lot more doors for me in terms of career opportunity. And so when you look at some of the things I've done later in life, I've really invested in a lot of creative things that I wanted to pursue probably when I was younger, but now I can do it now I'm older. So taking on screenwriting at the Sundance Institute, getting a degree in a creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania, but this time in the liberal arts school, becoming a video and film editor. And getting certified in that. So I've definitely tried to balance what was originally a very heavy STEM and business background with a lot more artistic creativity now that I'm older.
So what type of life did you experience during your ascension to Wall Street? We have all this idea of the Wolf of Wall Street, I guess.
Yeah, so I'll tell you that there's definitely elements of the Wolf of Wall Street that I experienced head on. So I worked at a firm where we were also involved in some of the scandals related to things like dwarf tossing and some of the funny scenes that you saw in the Wolf of Wall Street, where there's a lot of rambunctious behavior on the trading floor. We certainly had some of that. I remember earlier in my career, we were the financiers to Penthouse Magazine, and we had Penthouse Magazines all over the trading floor. Now, that would not obviously fly in 2022, but, you know, that was kind of the thing that people did in 1993. Mm-hmm. We also had, you know, situations where I was aware of, you know, bankers at other firms who were hooked on drugs and did cocaine before meetings. And it actually made them better bankers being high on cocaine. But for me, a lot of it was just the daily grind of working really, really hard, working 80 to 120 hours a week for 25 years and flying around the world and delivering you know, results for clients. I like to tell young people that are first interested in Wall Street, essentially what we do on Wall Street is we are providers of liquidity. We are the people that help people raise capital or sell their companies. And that is a universal need all over the world. And so it was not unusual for me, particularly when I became a senior banker, to be in Beijing, London, New York, and San Francisco all in a single week. I'll tell you, there's a story that I wrote about in my book, which was when I was 40 years old. I was at that point, I was already in the business for about 20 years. And I remember coming home one day and I received this nice black envelope from United Airlines. And I opened it up and inside there was a black card. And it said, there was a letter and it said, "Mr. Liu, welcome essentially to the Million Mile Club."
And nice.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, that's kind of nice, right? You know, I got this card, it says a million miler on it, you know, gives me all this extra status, you know, et cetera. And so, okay, great. And then a week later, I got a similar envelope. It wasn't black. I remember it was like blue. And this time it was from American Airlines. And this one also said, "Mr. Liu, welcome to the Million Mile Club," or something to that. And it was, there was a nice little blue card in there and it said, you know, million miles. I'm like, okay, great. And then a week later, I got one from Delta. And it also said, you know, welcome to the Million Mile Club. And so I went back and I went through all of my statements to just figure out, okay, how many miles do I actually have? And by the time I turned 40, I had flown 5 million actual miles, which, just to give you a sense of what that means that on average, I spent about 10,000 hours on an airplane somewhere for the first 20 years of my life. And if you're a fan of, you know, some of these, you know, heuristics and ideas, 10,000 hours generally is what people use as a benchmark for you to become an expert in something. So I looked at that and like, man, that's a lot of hours that was on an airplane. And so that was a big turning point for me in terms of thinking about making a career change and leaving the business. And so when I turned 40, that started the ball rolling for me to retire from Wall Street. And fortunately or unfortunately, you know, when you work at a firm on Wall Street and you're doing well there, trying to leave that firm is a little bit like leaving the mafia. You don't leave them, they leave you.
Yeah.
So it took me another 3 years to ultimately leave the industry, but I'm really glad that I did because I was able to then pursue lots of other things that I wanted to do.
Mm. So let's take a step back. I'm really interested about your time at Wall Street. And I wanted to ask you, did you ever feel conflicted with the environment around you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the environment is such that you're constantly in this, you know, sales mode where you're trying to convince people to hire you. And the reality is that there are probably 12 firms in the world that are the top investment banks, and they can all do a client's deal. It's a little bit like an oligopoly. Any of them can do your deal, but it's a game of inches. Who's going to get the choice assignment? Who's going to become the lead investor, lead banker, lead advisor? And so there were definitely situations in the industry where you have to, frankly, overpromise what you're able to deliver. And sometimes you don't know if you can do it. It might be the very first time you've ever tried that type of transaction. But, you know, you try to minimize that, frankly, because it catches up to you. And I always try to always over-deliver. So under-promise and over-deliver. And there were certainly times where I lost business because of that. And you get in situations where you see other firms do a lot of unethical things to win business. And you definitely have long nights where you're thinking about it. And I'll give you an example. For a while, I was running the Chinese internet group at my firm. And so I was spending a lot of time in China, and this was the early days of the first dot-com era. And we were, you know, a very small firm, not very well known in China, but I was pretty well known among the Chinese internet community because I had spent a lot of time there. And so we had opportunities. And there was one time where we were vying for a major role and we were going up against JP Morgan. And I remember one of the investors who was on the board said to me, hey, look, if you really want to win this lead role over JP Morgan, you got to do what they're doing. And I, you know, asked him, well, what exactly are they doing? And he said, you know what they're doing. You know, they're helping out. They're practicing, you know, relationship building with the CEO. And ultimately, I started to learn that what they were doing, and all this came out in the Wall Street Journal, was that they had created, JP Morgan had created something they called the Sons and Daughter Program, where they would essentially hire the sons and daughters of CEO prospects and give them plum jobs at the firm for basically doing nothing so that they could win business. And ultimately, this got all revealed, and it's essentially corruption in its purest form. And JP Morgan was fined, and the lead banker who was kind of in charge of that was pushed out of JP Morgan. So that kind of stuff, frankly, happens all the time, all over the world. And I think when you are involved in any industry, you're going to see that. And you just have to ask yourself, can you sleep at night? And for me, it was really about making sure that I could live with myself, but also understanding that I'm probably leaving money on the table. I'm probably leaving opportunity on the table, but that's okay, because I don't need to be the very best or make the most money, because there's essentially kind of this economics term called the winner's curse. And essentially what that means is that in an environment where everyone has perfect information, you know, and obviously this is a theoretical model, but if everyone has perfect information, the person who wins does something irrational, because if everybody acted rational, there's no way you could win. But if you're willing to do something irrational, then you're willing to win, and you win, and that's the winner's curse. And so for me, I've never wanted to get into that realm where I was doing anything unethical or anything untoward, because life's too short and I wanted to be able to live with myself.
Mm-hmm. So did you do any mistake that taught you an important lesson during your time on Wall Street?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Did you do any mistake that taught you an important lesson during your time at Wall Street?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've made so many mistakes in my career, and every single one of them has made me a better person. And I will tell you that earlier in my career, when I was junior, the mistakes that I would constantly make were related to not reading people correctly and not reading the situation correctly. So I write about this. There were situations where, you know, I'd be invited into a meeting and I would think that the way that I add value is by pointing out all the problems. I like to use analogies, and I talk about this in my book around being a stork, you know, being a pigeon, because what pigeons do is they fly in, they crap on everything, and then they leave. And unfortunately, a lot of people do this. And so when I was younger and I was like this smart ass, I would do that all the time. I thought that the way I add value was I would go into a meeting and I point out all these problems, right? Oh, you know, you didn't think about this or that, right? And I was a pigeon because time would run out and I had to bail. I had to leave. And what I learned is that that doesn't ingratiate you to anyone. In fact, it makes people think about you as kind of a jerk. And they start to think about you as the kind of person that if we ever had to eliminate anybody, if there's anybody that we did not want to promote, it'd be that person, because all they do is come up with problems. And one thing that we all know when you're running any kind of business is there's no shortage of problems, right? And so by doing that many times when I was younger, I realized that that's a one-way trip off a cliff. But the way that you really accelerate your career is rather than being a pigeon, you be a stork. And a stork is essentially the bird that was popularized by Hans Christian Andersen, where the bird comes and delivers the baby. So deliver solutions. So when I was younger, I would always be a pigeon. But then as I got older, I started to turn into more of a stork. So whenever I identified any challenges or issues in a meeting, I would always try to come up with a solution so that people would say, like, you know, yeah, Dave raised a lot of good points, but he also had some good ideas, right? He came with some ideas and thoughts. And I will tell you that as a young person kind of rising your career, this is the single best way to make yourself known, because people love people who bring ideas, particularly if they can solve problems. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about that and doing that, but I only would have learned that if I hadn't, you know, been such a screw up, you know, when I was younger and tried to be the smart ass who's constantly saying, you know, look how smart I am. And unfortunately, I learned this really young. When I was at Goldman Sachs, Remember, I was only 18 when I did this. I was in a meeting one time with my boss, and my boss was presenting, and he got one fact wrong. And it was actually something that I had worked on. So I knew that what he said was wrong. And so, you know, I raised my hand and I pointed it out because I thought that, hey, man, you know, I'm going to correct it so that everything's correct. And this is how I'm going to add value. And what I didn't realize was my boss's boss was in the meeting. So essentially, I embarrassed my boss. And for the rest of the summer, he never invited me to another meeting again. So I've made lots of these kind of mistakes earlier in my career, and they really helped me. You know, another mistake I made when I was kind of a mid-level person trying to rise to the top was I realized that the way you rise to the top in an investment bank is you have to be essentially a salesperson. You have to be someone that can deliver clients and relationships. So I would go out and I would pitch as a mid-level person. I would go pitch prospects, and I was terrible at reading the room. I was terrible at like picking up social cues, because what I would do is I would go into a meeting with a prospect, and I would have like 100-page pitch book, and I would start going through it and talking through like, oh, look at all this great analysis we did, and look at these pretty charts and all this stuff, right? And I never really understood what was happening until I realized that I'm not getting invited back to any of these meetings. Like, none of these people are responding to my follow-ups, right? And then what I slowly realized was that my meetings were terrible. Like, I was boring people to tears, and I wasn't talking about what they wanted to talk about. So as I started to learn from my mistakes, I would stop bringing the books. I would stop bringing the 100-page Bible to the meeting, and I would just have a conversation. And I would read the CEO client, and I would pick up like, oh, I see, he or she is kind of interested in this topic. So let's go down that path, right? And then slowly but surely, as you start to develop rapport with people and they see the time that they're spending with you as being productive and valuable to them, then you get called back. And so the more interactions you have with someone, then that ultimately builds a relationship. So I kind of, in my mid-career, I kind of messed up the whole relationship building thing. And I was definitely on a one-way path off a cliff if I didn't course correct. But thankfully, I was able to kind of identify, largely through data, by looking at the fact that nobody was responding back and wanted to see me again. By looking at the data, I realized I got to do something different because something here is not working.
Lots of food for thought there. So did you have any enlightening moment during your career that changed the direction of your life?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, there have been a lot that I'd say they're micro meetings, small things that really changed the direction of my life. I think one of the main ones was with selecting and determining who was going to be my champion or my mentor in my firm. And I tell people this all the time. Like, if you work at a company, the ideal mentor is someone of the same gender and ethnicity as you, because they are the most likely to have gone through what you are going to experience in that organization. And if they can show you the landmines, the HOV lanes, the shadow org charts, like, they'll help you a lot in accelerating your career. Unfortunately, Wall Street is primarily still dominated by white men. And so when I was a young guy, there were no senior level Asian Americans at the firm. And so what I did, because the firm was quite small when I joined my firm, we only had about 200 employees and we only had 20 bankers, and I was in the banking group. So it was quite small. What I decided to do was I just decided to aim as high as I could. And so the person that ultimately became my champion, my mentor, looked out for me, was the CEO of the firm. And I think I got really lucky because fast forward 30 plus years later, What I realized about him was that he was just a genuinely really nice person. And he's been very successful in his own right. But I think he saw something in me that might have reminded him of his son or his grandson or someone like that. And I think he really resonated with my story of challenges and overcoming them. And so he really took me under his wing and helped me. He helped me with counseling on how to get into business school. He wrote my recommendation to Stanford and to Harvard. He was a big proponent. And that was a pivotal relationship that I developed over time, because whenever I had challenges, frankly, with compensation or promotion, while he was still CEO of the firm, I would make sure that he was aware of those challenges. And a lot of times, you know, I'm sure whatever influence he had was behind the scenes, but everything generally worked out in my favor. So clearly, knowing the right people and having the right champions was a huge impact on making sure that I was able to realize kind of my full potential at the firm.
So you mentioned earlier that you left your high profile, high paying job in your early 40s on your own terms while still on top. And you say that walking away from a lucrative job at a prestige firm was like resigning from the mafia, but you did it anyway to save your life, your family, and your sanity. How and when did you start thinking about leaving your career behind? And why did that save your life, your family, and your sanity?
Yeah, so I started actually thinking about it right around when I was promoted to the managing director job, which was in my early 30s. So I knew that I was really entering a period where I would be maximizing my earnings potential, because now I was a partner, essentially. I had signing authority and I had a team working for me. But I also saw what had happened to lots of people in the industry, people that had progressed beyond where I had. And being very open, I saw a lot of people that were unhappy. They made a lot of money and were very powerful, but fundamentally were not happy people. They were, in many ways, the cliche. And we all know things become a cliche for a reason, because there's enough data to support it. And what I saw was a lot of broken marriages. I saw a lot of people that did not really have a good relationship with their children, and people that fundamentally were unhappy. And they would talk to me about, yeah, you know, this job's a drag, but, you know, man, I need those bonus checks because, you know, I got, you know, a third house to pay for and private school and alimony, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so what I live by is the idea that I don't ever want to care about what other people think of me. And I think that one of the most insidious, dangerous things is this notion of comparing yourself to others or keeping up with the Joneses, trying to compare yourself to all these people around you. And it's very, very difficult, right? I mean, frankly, I think that's part of the reason why social media has been so damaging to the psyche of a lot of people, because we're constantly seeing all the success that other people have and we feel less human ourselves. So for me, I've always tried to ignore that. And one of the things that I swore to myself was that if I could save enough money by the time I turned 40, then I would walk away, because there's no amount of money that's worth my happiness. And one of the things that's really important to me and to my wife was to have a family, and to, for me, to not be that absentee dad who's never around. The cliche that, frankly, a lot of my partners were. So I decided in my early 30s to work towards that. So I was really frugal. I never spent a bonus check, and I would live definitely within my salary. And when my partners were buying sports cars and very expensive high-end BMWs and Mercedes and second homes and all that kind of stuff. Like I stayed in the same home I bought, the very first house that I bought. I'm still in it today. And I drove a Honda S2000 and I drove that even as a managing director. And some of my partners, I know were making fun of me because of that. But because I was so cognizant of being able to walk away on my own terms in my early 40s, I was really religious about staying on track and squirreling away as much money as I could so that by the time I turned 40, I would have the flexibility to either stay or leave. And there was a lot of dominoes that fell around my early 40s, but I would say it's really first and foremost family. I had my second child when I was 40. And at that point, I had a firstborn who was about 3 years old. And I was really worried that I wasn't spending enough time with him. And I didn't want that to happen with my second child. So the birth of my second boy really was a wake-up call. Like, okay, are you really going to do this or not? Are you really going to exit or not? And I said, yeah, I'm going to exit because now I have the financial freedom to do that. And I had a wife who was super supportive of it. And she said, look, you know, you got another whole half of your life that you can do whatever you want. And we have the flexibility to do that. So I'd say it was first and foremost family, but then I started to feel like I kind of accomplished everything that I wanted to and could on Wall Street. Certainly I could continue to progress and get to, you know, one day executive committee and maybe one day kind of CEO, but that wasn't really interesting to me. And so that's why ultimately I decided it was time to move on.
What challenges did you have to overcome to leave your career behind and start your new life?
You know, the main thing I think is more mental, which was your whole self-worth and your whole expertise and your personal brand are tied up in your career. You know, I think that I've thought a lot about this. You know, if you think about your work life and your personal life, you developed your own brand in both of those, right? So, and let's start with the personal side. So on the personal side, you develop a brand as a parent, you develop a brand as a husband or a wife, you develop a brand within your circle of friends in those regards, right? But that's a very small circle of people that really matter. And that brand is really unique to you. And in a strange way, everybody shares that brand. Anyone that's a dad out there has that same brand, right? So interestingly, it's not easy to develop differentiation beyond like that small circle, right? And I think that's why a lot of us invest so much time and effort in our work life, because our work life not only generates the resources for us to live, but also it also gives us a sense of branding and value to the external world. And so I think when I was leaving the industry, and I see this with a lot of my friends who change careers, your whole brand to the external world is wrapped up in your career. And you worry about what impact that will have on the way people think about you, as well as even your own legacy, like if you leave that industry. And so for me, a lot of my external brand was wrapped up in being this great technology banker and being this guy who, you know, was able to see trends in the internet space, you know, earlier than a lot of other people. And I worried about, okay, if I exit stage right and I do something completely different, not only am I abandoning that brand that I've spent 30 years developing, but I could really be screwing up my external brand to the world by doing something that is a complete failure. And so I think that's kind of one of the biggest challenges mentally. You just kind of have to get over that. And for me, I think being focused on not caring what other people think, and then focus more on the smaller internal brand that you have with your friends and family is much more important. And one of the studies that I read about and have been following for a long time has a huge impact on me is the Grant study which is done by Harvard Medical School. And the grant study essentially is a longitudinal study of a class of graduates from Harvard over a long period of time. And what they're trying to figure out over this, you know, 40, 50 year period is what are the keys behind healthy aging and happiness related to that. And they really found two main things. One is that the people that towards the end of their life have had the healthiest aging, the happiest end of life, were people that were able to deal with adverse situations and bounce back. So they had good defensive mechanisms, right? And then the second thing is that they had a pool of strong long-term relationships that they had invested in, and these other people had invested in them. And most of the time, it related to their family or to a close circle of friends. Now, notice that what they didn't find was people with a lot of wealth, right? Money had no correlation to this at all. It wasn't people that were really powerful. It wasn't people that had a lot of people working for them. And it certainly wasn't people with a lot of followers on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok, right? And so when I read that and I followed it, it really resonated with me, because I think that when you're making a career change, you first have to mentally get over the fact that you're going to be redefining yourself in some way, but you also need to think about the people that really matter are the people like your close circle of friends and your family. And as long as they understand why you're doing it and you can empathize with them and they can relate to you, then I think you're fine. I think where it gets really scary and you can put yourself in a really tough mental spot is if you change careers and you aren't as successful, right, as you were in that other career, and you let this, you know, amorphous social media crowd like dictate how you should think about yourself. I think that's where you can get in a lot of trouble. So for me, that, I think mentally being ready for that change and doing different things, I think was a big stumbling block, a big hurdle that I wanted to overcome.
So what did you do after that?
So I did a bunch of things. First and foremost, when I was a banker, I was essentially, like I said earlier, in the business of providing liquidity to a lot of other founders and CEOs. And I made a lot of people really, really wealthy through IPOs and through selling their companies. And it was incredibly rewarding for me, not only financially, but also psychically. It's a little bit like as a banker, you're the Sherpa and you're helping all these people get to Mount Everest, to the top, right? It's great. But there was a little part of me that wondered, you know, could I also be the person to scale the summit on my own? Could I be more than just Sherpa? Could I be that person that plants the flag? And before, you know, I get put into the ground, I wanted to see if I could do that. So one of the things that I started to investigate when I was in the process of leaving the business of Wall Street was to see if I could be an entrepreneur. And so I ultimately did that over a 7-8 year period. I started 4 companies, one in technology, which ultimately got to almost 1,000 employees, one in asset management, where we were investing not only our own capital, but other people's capital. I started a merchant banking firm, and I also started a media production company. And on the merchant banking firm, what was incredibly rewarding for me was that I decided to do things a little differently. I had been observant and worked with lots of the top investors in Silicon Valley for a long time. And what I noticed was that there was kind of two types of firms that did really well over, you know, 20, 30 years. One was the kind of firm that really developed some core expertise in some areas, and they were really good at picking and choosing the winners in that category. But you needed a lot of resources and expertise, and you needed a good team to do that. And I wasn't really interested in building like a huge team to do investing and to advise companies. And then the second type of firm that was super successful were those that just invested in everything. So if you saw the beginning of the internet, you just invested in everything because you knew that the whole category was going to do well. So Web 1.0, Web 2.0, now Web 3, right? It's like, let's just invest in everything because we know that some are going to die, but some are going to be great. And the whole tide is rising. So for me, I actually developed a different model. What I saw for myself was I liked being an advisor to companies. I actually enjoyed that part. But what I didn't enjoy was flying 5 million miles around the planet and not being at home. And so rather than chase every single deal on the planet, I would just focus on those companies, those founders that I really, really liked. And I would invest my own money and I would invest my time with those companies. And essentially, I would become their right-hand person. I'm a big fan of The Godfather, the film The Godfather. And in The Godfather, The Godfather has a consigliere who is the right-hand man. And in The Godfather, the main person is Tom Hagen, who is played by Robert Duvall. And I like to be the Tom Hagen to founders. So when you look at my track record in investing, I've actually not done a lot of deals. I have done probably around 12 deals over an 8 to 9 year period. That's not a lot. But in each of these companies, I like to think of myself as the Tom Hagen to the CEO. I'm the person that they call when they're interested in acquiring something, when they're interested in maybe taking the company public or selling it. I'm also the person they call when they just need someone to talk to. You know, it's kind of like, hey, man, running a company is really hard. You know, you've been there. How did you deal with this or that? So when I left Wall Street, I became an entrepreneur. And as you can tell from, you know, the four different areas that I just talked about, some were like your traditional Silicon Valley startup. You know, we're building a product, right? We're going to change the world with a product. And some of them, like asset management and merchant banking, leveraged a lot of what I was doing for 25 years before I became an entrepreneur. But now I was doing it on my own terms with my own company. And it's been incredibly rewarding to do that. And then the last company I mentioned is the media company. And I'm a huge believer in representation, and representation matters. And I have a personal interest in helping Asian Americans. So I have not only written the book, but also invested and counseled companies that are founded by Asian Americans in the TV, the film, Broadway, a variety of different entertainment categories as well.
Mm. So I guess so what you mentioned is probably the answer to the next question, but I'm going to go through it. We often forget how each of us with our choices can have a positive impact on the world. How do you feel your career changes made the world a better place?
Yeah, so I'd like to think that I've made the world a better place by two things. One is by just sharing ideas. And I'll be honest, when I was a banker, I was working so hard and I was trying to do the best I could for my clients. I didn't really have time to share what I knew. I would share in small circles with founders how to maximize their company for an IPO or for a sale. And in a micro environment, I was helping that way. Right. I was helping provide jobs and helping people realize their dream. But when I left Wall Street, I realized that I've been very, very lucky in my life and very fortunate. And one of the things that I think I could do was to help people that feel underrepresented or disadvantaged in any way maximize their full potential. Because I do believe that a lot of unhappiness in the world is driven by people feeling lost. And frankly, a lot of us find meaning in work. And when we don't feel that we are being compensated correctly, when we don't feel that we are appreciated or realizing that title or promotion that we think we deserve, then we are unhappy. And I do believe that that's a big part of the reason why the vast majority of people that work are actually unhappy. And so one of the things that I did was I decided to memorialize these tips, tricks, and tactics that work for me and share it with the world. Originally, this started off as a project for my two boys. And when some of my friends got wind of the manuscript that I was developing for them, they said, hey, you should share this with the world, because I think there's a lot of people that feel underrepresented and could benefit from your teachings. And, you know, there's nothing really revolutionary in my book and what I share with the world, but I do think it's a different mindset. And I think that if I were to kind of summarize it, I really think that there's a lot of people in the world that believe that the work environment is a meritocracy, and that if you work hard and you add value, you will get everything you deserve. And I just don't believe that. And I haven't seen that. I see constantly, even to this day, the people that get ahead treat work like a game, and the rules are constantly changing, and they figure out how to maneuver the organization to benefit themselves. And I am definitely not talking about anything unethical or illegal, but we all know, and we've seen this in many companies, there's lots of people that don't work that hard, that aren't that smart, but seem to have all the power. And I think a lot of it is because they've learned all these tricks. They know how to maneuver and play the game to their advantage. So one of the ways that I try to effectively spread happiness is by sharing this with people, so that they can see the world a little differently. And then maybe they're able to get that promotion they always wanted, or get paid, maybe not completely fairly, but a little less unfairly, so that they're a little bit more happy. So that's one way that I've tried to, help. And then if you kind of double click on, my ethnic background, I think a lot of Asian Americans are very frustrated, particularly in corporate America, because when you read some of the research from Harvard Business School, Asian Americans are actually the least likely to get promoted. And the way the math works is that in a lot of industries, Asian Americans work their ass off to get in. So when you look at Wall Street and you look at Silicon Valley, Asian Americans actually over-index at the junior level, but they under-index at the senior level. So if you just do the math, the attrition rate must be the highest of any category. And that's exactly what happens. And so you have terms like the bamboo ceiling, which is kind of the Asian American equivalent for women of the glass ceiling. And it's a real thing. And the data shows that. So for my specific ethnic community, my hope is that by sharing what I know, I can help more Asian Americans crack through the bamboo ceiling. But by no means is what I preach and what I share specific just to Asian Americans. I think, again, like I wrote this book in order to help people that feel underrepresented. You can be a woman, you can be, African-American. I think there's a lot of things that you're not really taught when you're younger and when you're early in your career, and you kind of learn the hard way. And I'm trying to kind of save a lot of people that time. And then last but not least, I am definitely in give back mode. So I've made it very clear that any of the proceeds from my, content endeavors, or writing books, making film, whatever, I'm pledging all that to charity. And my goal is really not so much the dollar amounts that I give, but more raise awareness for these different charities that I think aren't necessarily the really big ones like the American Red Cross, but they're ones that are really important to me. So for example, I'm the chairman of the philanthropic advisory council at Smile Train. Smile Train is an organization that helps cleft affected people around the world, people born with clefts. And I happen to be one of them. I was actually born with a really severe one. And what few people realize is that the mortality rate for cleft affected people is really, really high. If your cleft is not treated, then by the age of 18, more than 90% die. So it's a real challenge, and it's something that's highly correctable with resources. And then I also donate and are focused on Asian American charities that are trying to stop Asian hate, which is still going on, frankly, all the time in America. I don't know if it's occurring in Europe as much, but in America, it's still happening all the time. And I'm just trying to help media and other outlets that are focused on helping get more Asian American voices and faces in the news and in the media as well. So that's kind of how, in a small way, I'm hopeful that, you know, I'll make the world a little bit better than it was when I got here. And I really do believe that the way that we can all make a positive difference is we focus on those things that are important to us, and then we give it our all.
So I would like quickly to read a few quotes that I took from your website. And I would like you to make a short comment. We are already, I think, over 1 hour at the moment. So, but the first one, if you can make it in the Machiavellian world of banking, you can make it anywhere. Wall Street is a jungle, the thousandth jungle there is.
Yeah, you know, I think that is absolutely the case. When I was formulating the idea for this book, I actually purposely made it a book where it's not actually heavy on Wall Street from a tactical standpoint. What it does is it uses Wall Street as a crucible from which one can develop tactics that will work in any highly competitive industry, whether that be Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, what have you. And I really do believe that because Wall Street is a really interesting environment. It typically is among the highest paid industries in the world. I think, in fact, if you look at, for instance, the metro cities like LA, San Francisco, New York, the number one highest paid profession is actually financial services. So it's already defined as probably the highest paying. And one of the things that we all know about human nature is that compensation becomes the candle to the moth. And when there's a lot of money at stake, that generally attracts the best and the brightest to some degree. And so I saw that in my own experience on Wall Street. Some of the smartest, hardest working people that graduate from some of the top universities in America go to Wall Street. And they may not stay because it's frankly a really tough industry, but they certainly go. And so I think that when I look at Wall Street, I see people that are not only super smart, but work really, really hard, all in the service of trying to build wealth. And I saw that a lot of the ways that you maneuver and that you ascend on Wall Street are highly applicable to other industries, like I said before. And so that's why that quote and that comment is in there, because my book is really about taking learnings from this Wall Street jungle and being able to articulate and translate that into other industries that are also highly competitive.
And the second one, you say that the corporate game is exactly that, a game.
Yeah, so I really believe that this is part of the reason why people are really frustrated. People think of the corporation very similar to academics. When you're going through life up until you first start your career, in many ways it's highly defined, right? You go to school, your teacher tells you to do a bunch of stuff. There's homework to make sure that you're learning what they're teaching you. And then there are tests to double check that you really are learning what you're doing. And we, in many ways, the input output is highly defined throughout our younger lives. But then you get to the corporate world and you realize quickly that the rules that you're told aren't necessarily the rules that apply to everybody. And I'll tell you a quick story. I gave a keynote speech at a conference where there was a lot of minorities there. And I asked the audience, I said, how many of you guys believe that the corporate environment is fair, right? And a few hands kind of went up. Not a lot, but a few. And then I said, for all of you that believe that, let me ask you another question. Do you ever have anyone in your work environment, either a coworker or a boss, that you look at and you wonder, how the hell does this person have this job? How is this person my boss? And every hand went up. And I said to them, that's why you know that it's not fair, that something, there's other ways to get ahead in your company. And the key is to figure out what those are as fast as you can. Because if you don't figure those out, you're going down a path of frustration. You're going to be working for people that you go like, I don't know what this person does, but I need to figure it out fast because I can't continue working for this person. And so that's why I say that there's a whole bunch of unwritten rules that you need to learn. And unfortunately, every company is different. Every company is a conglomeration of people, and we all know people are different. So I wish I could tell you like what are the unwritten rules at your company, but I can't. And that's why going full circle, that's why I said one of the best ways to kind of figure that out quickly is to actually find someone in the organization that's more senior than you, that's been there a while, that is the same gender and same ethnicity, because they have seen some of these challenges. They kind of know what the unwritten rules are. And the rules are always going to be changing, but they can at least download to you like the latest state of the art, the latest playbook. The playbook may not work like a year from now, 2 years from now, but they can at least teach you what has worked up to that point. And that's why I say that the corporate environment is a game and the rules are constantly fluid and they're, and you need to figure those out as fast as you can. Otherwise, you're going to be highly frustrated.
Well, it's been amazing having you here, and we are approaching the end of this episode. Even so, I wrote so many more questions. Maybe we'll keep it for another time. But really, the last question, if you could give yourself a piece of advice, what would you say to your younger self?
Yeah, the best advice I would give to myself is, and I say this to myself all the time, and I give a lot of speeches at universities, and I say this to them, to young kids, is like, invest in people. Like, and I know that sounds really cliche, but when I was younger, I invested a lot in learning about, you know, math and science, and that's all great. But what I wish I had done earlier was really invest in people and understanding people, understanding what makes people tick. Because if I would say, if there was anything in my career that really helped me and helped me kind of hit that escape velocity, was really starting to really understand that people are irrational, that everyone's different, but that the key to getting ahead in life is actually to figure out what is motivating people. What are the incentives that are necessary to get them to do what you want them to do? And these are things that, unfortunately, you can't learn in a book. And you need to learn by trial and error and with a lot of practice and with interacting with a lot of people. And I think that if you do that, if you invest in people and learning and understanding people earlier in career, I think that opens up a lot more opportunity for you. Because let's face it, unless you are a writer in a solitary cabin by yourself, you're going to have to learn how to work with people. You're going to have to learn how to mobilize a team, how to get customers to buy your product, how to get investors to invest in your company. And all of the same rules apply around investing in people. Like, it's the same kind of rules, like the same motivational tricks or incentives that get people to invest in your company are the same way to get people to join your company, the same way that you get people that work for you to work a little extra time to help you get that project done. And so, again, if I could go back in time, that's what I would say to myself. Invest in people, invest in learning in people, and it will bear dividends for you throughout your entire life.
Well, thank you, Dave, for joining us today and sharing your inspirational career change story and wisdom with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And the last message for our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to our channel and tune in next week for a new inspirational episode of The Career Changers. Thank you.